talking about mind techniques, choices with Eldon Taylor. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls, and maybe you might want to share your story of the choices you've made in your life, and if you change them, if you had a chance. Welcome back, Eldon Taylor with us. Eldon, as we look at most of the things that have been happening in our lives, subliminal programming is out there all the time, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, both the technical subliminal, meaning that it's been masked in a way that it, you know, you need equipment in order to uncover it, whether it's audio or it's visual, but also, you know, the more subtle subliminal, the logo, the place ad placements, the what we think of as superliminal. You see it, but you're not acknowledging that it's there. And so, in a sense, it becomes a subliminal message as well. And we know that these messages have a direct impact on us, and indeed often are prioritized over all other information. So that, you know, like Poetzel showed us at the turn of the century, not only are we processing the information maybe in our sleep, incorporating it in dreams and things of that nature, but it sits in the back of our mind, and it can be the motivating factor that causes us to buy a product or to avoid a person. So the answer to your question is absolutely. And, you know, interestingly, George, still to this day, and I, this is something I have been passionate about for nearly 30 years now, to this day, the large majority of the American public believes that it's illegal to for someone to use a subliminal message to sell you a product.
No, you're right.
Idea.
You're right.
And the fact of the matter is, it couldn't be further from the truth. You know, I like to explain to people, during the Gore Bush campaign, Gore's people pulled rats out of the word bureaucrats, imposed it heavily and very large above Gore's head. It was a single frame among 15 frames, not something that you could consciously see. The Democratic National Party, the DNC, became, first it was discovered, and then they became enraged. They pursued it as far as you could pursue it, and there was absolutely nothing that could be done. The reason for that is this. The only thing that stops someone from exposing you to that is an FCC codification that essentially threatens a station. It may lose its license if they, and here's the operative word, knowingly broadcast a subliminal message.
So you mean if the advertiser leaks it in there,
yep,
doesn't tell the radio or television station,
yep,
the station's off the hook.
That's exactly right. As long as there is plausible denial, they're off the
okay,
hook.
Okay, so let's say in the case of a TV commercial,
right,
somebody's looking at it, their standards traffic department. What are the odds of them seeing the subliminal message? They won't see it, will they?
No, they will not.
Unless they freeze frame every frame.
They just about have to examine every single frame. That's exactly right. And advertisers know that. Media people know that. I mean, and listen, here's the interesting thing. Take the Gore Bush ad.
But it's not illegal for the advertiser to do it.
No, not at all illegal. They get paid big bucks to do it. And as I started to say, take that Gore Bush ad. The University of Adelphi, Adelphi University, I should say, in New York, ran a study duplicating the scenario that went on between Gore and Bush and utilizing the ad with one group and not utilizing it with another. And the data is very robust. It clearly shows that that ad had an influence on the election.
That's amazing.
Now,
truly amazing.
Take it a step further. You know, one of the hot buttons right now that's going on is search engines can predispose you, give rise to propelling your decision in directions. So politicians are very aware that The search engine now becomes the next most important means by which they get their message across to you. If that search engine places you high...
Very high. You got to be on that first page.
That's right. If it places you very high, what is the implicit priming message that is attached to that?
In terms of placing you high?
Sure.
That's the preferred thing.
Yeah. That's what everybody wants. So we begin to see, we're seeing some articles appear. We're seeing some research that's being done that is demonstrating clearly how the search engine can be manipulated to win approval or disapproval for ideas, to, for all intent and purposes, influence voters in how they vote.
Yeah, truly amazing work.
Yeah, and all of that, again, in context, is not something that I'm consciously aware of taking place. And because I don't consciously detect it, we tend to think of it as having a subliminal nature. So you have the subliminal, like the rats ad, one slide and 15. Okay, you've got to hunt that down. But you've also got these other means by which you're being imparted a message, and you're unaware that that symbol, that message is being imparted, but it is indeed influencing your choice, your decision.
Are you seeing a change in subliminal messaging than the last several years?
Well, you know, the answer to that is yes and no. First of all, we see that negative messages seem to have a more immediate impact now. The research is pretty clear in that regard. In fact, the negative messaging, like negative campaigns, has its place. We tend to see that some of the, where we used to think that you'd use a subliminal to motivate people to do things, take the anti-theft message in a retail store. It's an anti-theft message, all right, but it's also a motivational message to say buying is honest, isn't it? So buying is honest. We used to think that we'd have these positive messages that would motivate us toward things. What we've learned is that those negative messages that motivate us away from things can be just as advantageous, more so in many instances, as those positive messages. They tend to be acted upon quicker. So we do see that. But we're also seeing, I've seen the whole field move. 30 years ago, there was a great deal of controversy about whether or not a subliminal message could, you know, be could influence a person at all. I mean, the process of, do we even detect it? Do we even see it or hear it? That was something that was suspect. And despite the work of people like Postel and Dixon, it was still considered to be novel enough that it wasn't thoroughly accepted. I've seen it go from that to where, okay, there's no doubt but what we process it. In fact, MRI technology shows us exactly when we process it and how we process it and where we process it. So it's not a question of whether or not we process it, but it doesn't influence behavior. And then the next step was, well, okay, it influences behavior. Now the data is pretty robust there. It shows it influences behavior, but there's a limitation as to how much behavior it influences and for how long. And that's basically where we are today. There is no question but what it doesn't influence behavior. The question remaining is, how long do these priming effects reside with us? How long is that subliminal content tumbled in our own minds, and when does it become a part of our own stream of consciousness? Now, you know, part of my work, as you know, George, has been with a technology we patented called InnerTalk. And it is a dichotically masked way of delivering a subliminal message. It's hidden in the sense that you don't detect it right away, but it's not buried. It is there, and you can pan your speakers and detect it. You can listen to it that way, but that's another point. We initially used this technology Well, I shouldn't say initially, because I initially used it in a lie detection practice. But the first time I ran a good study, it was at the Utah State Prison. And what we did at the Utah State Prison was work to lower hostility and aggression and interrupt recidivity rates down the, you know, down the highway. They're kept in three-year aggregates, so we had to wait 3 years to look at the recidivity rates. But what we found is that this subliminal content had the ability to prime the way inmates were talking to themselves, and in that way, change their expectation. And in changing their expectation, we were very successful at lowering hostility and aggression, increasing reflectivity, so much so that the prison system installed libraries throughout all of their facilities, and it was cloned out to other prisons. Well, you know, if you fast forward from that to today, there's more and more evidence that, you know, the technology not only has these hidden, more sinister possibilities in it, but the technology has some great opportunities for us to rewrite that negative, self-limiting dialogue that we live with on a daily basis that tells us we're not good enough, or we're not smart enough, or we're insufficient, and or, you know, so forth.
Eldon, tell us a little bit about in South Africa, where they used to rush up and beat up people for confessions. Now they use different techniques.
You know, I have a friend, he's a lie detection examiner in South Africa. He came over to the States. Well, we did some custom work for him, created some subliminal programs for interrogation, because he totally opposed the way things were being handled. And you know, he had a marvelous story that fits a lot of us, you know, but he talked about the culture in South Africa as though it were unique. And the story actually comes back and can be canned to look at how many people live their lives here. But the story, and I'll share that if you don't mind, the story is about people. Well, my mother used to call it birds of a feather flock together. And he basically was referring to how people tend to gather to share the bad things that happen to them in life, or the way they do things, why they interrogate in a certain way, and what they get out of those interrogations. And he called this this method, this analogy that he had, well, I can't say it. It's one of the seven words that we never say on radio.
Yeah,
so we'll,
right,
we'll
exactly.
Say crap cookies, okay? I can say that word. He called it his crap cookie philosophy. And what he said is, you know, these people, they store up their crap cookies so that they can share them, so that they can get together, so that, you know, hey, you know what happened to me today? My boss did this to me. Oh, that is so terrible. Do you know what my boy said to me this morning when I was talking? Oh, I can't believe it. That's shocking. Oh, you know, as bad as that was. Let me tell you my story. In other words, they gather to reinforce the negativity in their life. They gather to reinforce their methods of doing things, their methods of conducting business. Well, in South Africa, the method of obtaining a confession was, you know, if they didn't confess the first time, hit them with something tougher the next time. They beat confessions out of them. We did create a custom program, and we took this custom program to South Africa, and it worked very, very well. And they were so pleased with it that I got several letters, notes, and emails about, you know, how wonderful it was and how well it was working, and how they didn't really have to beat people now. They just maybe palms, you know. But I have to tell you this, George, it was really funny. Maybe a year after they had it, I got this emergency phone call in the middle of the night. The answering service is forwarding an urgent phone caller from South Africa. There, and this was audio cassettes at the time. Their audio cassette was broken. They needed another one. right away because they had interrogations that they had to, you know, they had become dependent upon it, which is an unfortunate side and unnecessary side as well. But nevertheless, that's the story. That's what took place.
Let me ask you about forgiveness and how that turns into choices. And you've looked at forgiveness and you think, like you used about the pot, that people need to do that.
Yeah, I think that's a starting point, boy, and that is...
It's not easy.
But that is the very big one. You know, look, I'm out at the Utah State Prison. I'm a very successful criminalist. I've got a great practice. I have got key people, great people working for me. Heck, I had Billy Bayshore, who headed the Nixon detail, running lie detection tests for me. So, you know, from the outward appearances, I am a successful fellow. I've got a nice automobile. I've even got a barn full of racing horses and a stable that's on the racetrack. So I look like I'm, you know. But I tell you, George, my life sucked. I mean, I was terribly unhappy. I was bitter. I was angry. I had a grudge against my father. We had had an altercation. I'd left home when I was very young. What I'd done is I'd found a socially acceptable way to act out all my anger. Mm-hmm. That was to go after so-called bad guys, okay? So we're out at the prison system. And we're interviewing all these inmates because the whole idea is to use this technology as an interdiction, as I said, to lower hostility and aggression. And we've used some very fancy psychometrics. This is back in the early 80s, and we have actually delivered computer-delivered examinations, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. We've used a incarcerated environment lens, the Fowler lens. We've looked at all this data, and when we're all said and done, we haven't learned anything. We have high scores in self and social alienation, which basically tell us that, you know, the inmate population has low self-esteem and a compensatory strategy. If they're not worth anything, you're not either, okay? Do it under you before you do it under them. Because, I mean, after all but for the grace of God, you'd be where they are, okay? If you had to deal with what they had to deal with. Well, you know, when you talk to these inmates and you hear everything and you're looking for how do you undo this? How do you get these people to take responsibility for their actions? I mean, instead of blaming it on this is what happened to me, this is what my daddy did, this is, you know, instead of displacing responsibility, how do we get them to take responsibility? And that became somewhat of a puzzle. Then, you know, it occurred that if what we did, I mean, it's impossible to blame if you've forgiven. So what if we were to create a program that had some real healthy self-esteem messages but was very strong on forgiving? I forgive myself. I forgive all others. I am forgiven. Now, understand, this is an inmate population, so you can see that there could have been some hesitations about telling an inmate you're forgiven.
Lots.
You know, okay? A lot of folks could say, well, he's going to think that, then he's just going to go out and do it again, you know? But that's not what happened. That's not how it worked. What happens when you have no one to blame is that you have the opportunity to do something about the circumstances. In other words, you're no longer bound by the fact that it happened to you. You're in charge of how you responded to it. You take the responsibility for how you responded, and that empowers you to make the changes in your life. Well, you know, George, what I did is, you know, it was that point in my life that I began to have my first ahas, or I'd probably still be carrying a gun and doing something else.
We'll get more into this when we come right back. Take a peek of our television program, Beyond Belief. You can also take a look at all the programs that have been done since the early part of this year. Go to beyondbelief.com, www.beyondbelief.com, and tell us what you think. Okay, welcome back, Eldon Taylor. With us, of course, Eldon, Let's talk a little bit about the work that you did with Inner Talk. Tell me about that, and how does that work?
Okay, well, I was just about to finish telling you about this prison study,
yeah,
the principle of forgiveness, and it all ties together. So let's just kind of pick it up there if we can.
All right.
And I'll tell you why, because I just, realized also that Charles McCusker, who I mentioned earlier, was the stat guy that handled the statistics at this study. So, Charlie, you get well, will you, buddy? Just get well. All right. Thanks for that indulgence, George. So where I was is, we've done this prison study, and what I've discovered is that, I am as guilty as these inmates of a kind of compensation. I am blaming everyone for the stuff that doesn't work in my life. And so if I'm going to change, I'm going to at least practice what I preach. And so I begin to work with this forgiveness process myself. Now, the inmate population did, as I say, outstanding. We have since that time farmed this out, used this technology with everything from the Barcelona Judo Olympic team and elite athletes to Fortune 500 executives. And indeed, for every listener out there, this program, Forgiving and Letting Go, is available free on my website. We have been giving it away for some 20 years because I believe it is the place that all self-improvement really begins from. I mean, you cannot proceed in life and grow beyond the boundaries that you limit yourself to, and blame is most assuredly one of those boundaries that stops you from moving forward. Okay, well, the technology then, InnerTalk, this is what we had used in the prison system. This is what I had designed to go out there. It was this dichotically masked information system. And what we did, George, is on one channel we delivered forward information that would go to, theoretically, your left brain for that right-handed person. And that forward information is all permissive. So it essentially says, it's okay to be good. It's okay to like yourself. It's okay to succeed. And the reason it does the it's okay is because if I tell it I am good, this little conscious sentry that is our stream of consciousness that contains even our defense strategies, another factor that could influence our choices, it may well argue with that, mitigate it, say, things like, sure, good at what? Do you remember when? How about? So if what I'm trying to do is build esteem, there's the fact that you have low self-esteem is a testimony to the idea that you have beliefs that you're somehow inadequate, you're somehow inferior, you somehow don't weigh in where you think you should weigh in, okay? So given that I can expect that, when I deliver a message that would say, I am good, I would expect that your conscious sentry, your left brain, that area that regulates the rules of reason and logic and language, is going to argue back with it. On the other hand, our right hemisphere, which is the spatial hemisphere, I can deliver it a set of messages that is authoritarian. So I can say on that channel, I am good. I like myself. Life is wonderful. And what we did then was deliver a set of permissive messages on one channel and a set of forward messages on the other channel, authoritarian messages. Now, because I believe we process information in reverse, and I believe you have done a show on reverse speech.
Yeah, I'm sure. And
I have a number of recordings, and David has a number of recordings of young children who go through a period where they look you straight in the eye. It's not goo-goo-ga-ga that they're saying. they're convinced they're saying something very meaningful, and every parent will relate to this, but you don't understand anything they're saying. Now, this is a very short period in their development, but we've all experienced it. When you take those recordings and you slow them down and play them backwards, you slow them down 10, 15%, play them backwards, you begin to get meaningful messages. Daddy play, mommy home. So, you know.
Little cute stuff.
Yeah. And you know, and in law enforcement, if you take, well, I'll give you the very first one that I ever came across. It was a lie detection test. The test was inconclusive. I was reviewing the charts because it was inconclusive, meaning that there was enough either situational stress or countermeasures employed that you couldn't, on the basis of the chart, say deception was indicated or not indicated. The relevance, the irrelevance were close enough to one another that you just couldn't call a chart. So I was evaluating this chart, looking at this chart, and I had the recording of the chart, and one of the old ooh hairs that, you know, all the old clandestine folks had, they would slow everything down to 15-16 IPS per second, or, you know, inches per second, very, very slow. And so I had slowed this down, and I was reversing it back with my finger, just turning the reel. And when I turned the reel back, the answer was no. When I turned the reel back to reset that answer to see how the chart responded lifetime to that recording, when I spun that reel back, what I heard was liar. I said, wait a minute, how do you get liar out of no? Huh. I brought, you know, some people in. Listen to this. Liar. Liar. On the strength of that alone, I brought the person back, and instead of go to a test, we went to interrogation as though he had a bad test, and he did confess, and we did have a recovery. So, you know, that was kind of like, you know, the proverbial nail in the coffin, but Oates has also assisted law enforcement in a number of instances where taking just a normal statement from perhaps a suspect, what did you do when you left home or when you left work? And the suspect says, well, you know, I went home. Well, I stopped at the store, but I went straight home other than that. When you reverse it, sometimes you get additive information, kind of the Freudian, a form of pareidolia. We get maybe a loaf of bread and milk. So I am absolutely convinced that we process information in reverse. And that would be consistent with Carl Prebrim's work on the holographic memory storage. You know, we've done a lot of work looking at memory, and, you know, you can cut literally every aspect of a brain away from a maze-bright rat that you think could possibly hold memory, and that rat will continue to be maze-bright. Well, the theory is we're not storing memory in n-grams and e-grams like I was taught when I went to school. That's dating myself. But we're storing it holographically. Now, if you think of that and the way I wrote it up, as a mirror imaging paradigm, what you really have is there is a convenient little toy. I can probably explain it best with that. That is just, it's a dish that has a mirror on the bottom, and then it has a top that sets down that is also a mirror. And there's a little cutout in the middle. If you take something like a strawberry and put it in the bottom of the dish, and then you put the mirror top over it so that it is all mirror, the strawberry appears above the top of the hole in the dish. And it looks, it's a holograph. It looks like it is a strawberry. I mean, and I can ask people, oh, get that strawberry for me, will you? And they'll try and pick it out of it. And of course,
they think it's real.
Yeah. And you know, it's a cute little device. I carry it with me when I'm lecturing. But here's the point. By mirroring the information from one hemisphere to the other hemisphere, we would have a forward and reverse. That just seemed logical to me. Young people typically will reverse their fives, their S's, and other letters. And And so what we did is we delivered one set of messages to the right hemisphere in reverse, and those were the authoritarian, and the other set of messages as permissive, it's okay, and in forward speech. When you deliver that way, you don't need to bury the messages. What happens is it's analogous to me throwing two balls at you at the same time, maybe throwing them to you 3 foot apart. In order for you to catch both those balls, you have to take your eyes off the ball. You literally have to allow your reflexes, your instincts, to pick those two balls up. If you try to look them both in, you'll drop one or both for sure. Well, the same thing happens when you task the two hemispheres simultaneously. They stop discriminating. It's kind of like that Stroop color test. And I explain all of this in choices. But if you take that Stroop color test where we color words, we take the word blue and we color it green. We take the word yellow, we color it red. We take the word red, we color it black. And then I ask you to read the color, not the word. And we have a whole row of these. Maybe each color is listed 3 or 4 times, but never in the color that it is. Or if it is, maybe only once. And I ask you to read the color. You will find that you can't do that. You'll revert to reading the rule of language. You will read yellow when it says yellow, as opposed to reading the color, even though the yellow is printed in red. So by employing that same channel differentiated tasking, we're able to bypass critical awareness and deliver information that becomes how you take aboard your self-talk. You begin to talk to yourself that way. We run all kinds of studies now, independent studies at major universities such as Stanford. We've had two governments actually commission studies on the technology. Ron Gordon, who's the co-founder of Atari, hired Julian Isaacs from John F. Kennedy and said, you know, I want to look at all the technologies that I could use in a franchise system I'm thinking about that would be the other 90%, how we could get people to use the other 90% of their brain. And I want you to test this InterTalk technology.
Mm-hmm.
So Julian obtained from us a number of different programs, as diverse as time management and depression. And he employed a very tight protocol and ran his studies, and the findings were really incredible. I was over the top about it, but Ron Gordon looked at him and said, no way, I don't believe him. Run the studies again. So he ran all of them a second time to come back in with the same kinds of numbers. Every study that we've run has come back with efficacy, George, and demonstrating efficacy, I should say. The real advantage to utilizing the technology in this way is that you empower yourself in the area that you choose to do so. You know, for a lot of people, well, I'm going to come back to the prison system. You know, what we did there was to lower hostility and aggression, and the forgiving program not only did that, but people.
Did it work?
It worked very, very well, yes. I mean, so well that the prison system, as I said, you know, made it a part and parcel of their social work. They put voluntary libraries in. But the inmates, they weren't attracted to this idea of forgiving and letting go, per se. They liked the rehabilitation idea. It was all volunteer in the beginning, but you know, as the word started to go, the only reason they were going after it was because of other perks that they might get through their social worker. But what we did hear from them is, you know, well, if he had a weightlifting program, I'd really be interested in that. Well, what we started doing was we'd take titles like weightlifting, bodybuilding, and so forth. We would build that title using the kinds of affirmations, the statements that would go through a successful bodybuilder's mind so that they became your inner talk. They became how you talk to yourself from the inside out. But we would include this boilerplating, this forgiveness set. That would become a part and parcel of them. And by doing that, what we ended up doing was creating, well, today, over 300 different titles that fit the needs of an individual, while at the same time, I think, going fundamentally at the beginning place for self-improvement, for personal growth.
That's amazing. Truly is. Good for you. Couple minutes to go before the break. I want to take phone calls with you next hour, Eldon. Questions, of course, but I want people to share with us the choices they made in their lives and whether they do that again. How many of us would want to change those choices, Eldon?
You know, that is a real good point. that's something I've been...
Boy, I have some, believe me.
Do you?
I'd want to change some.
I don't know, George. You know, when you look at where you are and you think about... if you'd have made a different choice, would you be there? You sometimes just kind of stop and think, well, you know, maybe not. There's a wonderful story. Take just a couple of minutes that I think illustrates that. It's a story, you know, of a farmer in the Civil War, and he and his boy are barely getting by. They're really very, very poor. And one day, you know, spring has come, the boy's out, he's got their only horse, an older horse, you know, and his plow and his harness, and they're in the field, and a storm comes up, and lightning strikes nearby, and this horse bolts, breaks the harness, and runs away. And the whole town comes out. Such bad luck. Such bad luck. The old farmer, he says, good luck, bad luck, who knows? The next day, that horse comes home with a whole herd of wild horses following it. And the two run out, and they get him in the corral, and they lock him up, and the whole town comes out. Such good luck. The old farmer, good luck, bad luck, who knows? The next day, the boy's out working those horses. He's going to train them, break them, or that's how they're going to make their money now, because horses are worth a lot. And doggone if he doesn't catch the first one, sunfish, flip over on him, break his leg. And the whole town, such bad luck, such bad luck. And the old farmer, good luck, bad luck, who knows? The next day, the army marches in and subscripts every able-bodied man. And they go off to war, and none of them come back. And the whole town, such good luck. That broken leg kept that boy at home, such good luck. And that old farmer, good luck, bad luck, who knows? I don't know if we really would change our choices. You know, sometimes our choices are, they appear to be the wrong thing for us to do. And on the other hand, when we look at where we are, maybe they weren't so wrong after all.
Yeah, maybe not, Eldon. Maybe not. But there are many choices I think all of us would like to review before we would do it again.
Boy, I totally agree with that one, George.
I wonder if we'll ever get that chance in another time zone, in another warped drive dimension.
You know, for what it's worth, I tend to think that we will. You know, one of the things that I did about a year ago was interview some 24 experts on life after death. They range from the folks that had electronic voice recordings to those that experienced NDEs to the neurosurgeons, and they're all pretty much coming back with a common denominator. I think you can count on an opportunity to do that review.
I think so. Let's come back with phone calls, questions, and choices next.